Hey, guess who I'm going to see tomorrow night?
Let's see. I'm going to guess Christopher Cross.
No, I'll give you him. Maybe I never.
You're going to see Willie?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, he's playing at the in the park up the hill.
Nice. God, this is weird. I almost feel like I need a new thing.
Welcome to the first East Coast edition of On Taking Pictures.
Right, like a new, like, you know.
Hey, gang, it's Tuesday.
Yeah, but I always do that. But it's still
hey
Tuesday.
Hey, gang, it's 11 a.m. for both Bill and I.
Right. The stars have aligned and we are in the same time zone. So it is Tuesday. And it is On Taking Pictures, and I am on the East Coast, and I couldn't be happier to be here. So, you know.
Welcome to the real America.
What? Well, believe me, I drove through the real America.
That's another show.
That's another show. That's right. So it is Tuesday. It's On Taking Pictures. It's episode 172. Big Q&A show today. So apologies in advance. You guys have been great. We've got a lot of questions. So I think we're probably going to be, this show's probably going to last until tomorrow.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah.
And it's funny because up until like, 2 days ago, I put up the thing last week about the Q&A, and there was like four questions, and I was like, oh, shoot, are we going to be... And then all of a sudden, I look, and there's like 17 pages of questions, which is great, so let's do it. Anything you want to say about your trip? You want to do a little quick thing?
Yeah, maybe a little quick. First, Jeffrey Sidoris, Bill Wadman, that's who we are.
Yeah.
Who you're listening to for the next 400 hours.
Yeah, welcome.
The trip.
Put on
2,720 miles.
2,720 miles. Not
2,720
bad.
Miles. Nine states. All three time zones covered. But I guess are there four? Wait, Pacific, Mountain, Central, Standard. I mean, Eastern.
You went through two in the middle, and you ended up in the third.
Right. But geez, you know, really fun. I didn't take as many photographs as I thought I would. Because frankly, it's a boring drive most of the time.
Yeah, it's a lot of flat nothingness.
Yeah. I mean,
especially coming the southern route that you did, because it's just desert the whole time.
Right. It wasn't really interesting until Tennessee.
Yeah.
And then it got real green and
I think the word you're looking for is lush.
Yeah, lush. Yeah, and you know what? It's a green. It's this sort of verdant green that you just don't have. There's almost in Southern California, even if there is green, there's almost a patina of brown over the top of it.
Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, but it was lovely. Had some great barbecue in Nashville at this place called the Peg Leg Porker, which was
really just Peg Leg Porker.
The Peg Leg Porker. Yeah.
Okay.
and their logo is this big pig with a wooden leg.
Wait, you didn't have any barbecue in Texas?
No, just drove through the panhandle.
Oh, up top, yeah.
And it was, you know, really just hammer down, just go. Memphis was great. I would love to go back and see more of Memphis. Did the whole Beale Street thing.
Yeah.
Went to a Waffle House, and it was funny. Getting gas, leaving town, guys like, California, you're a long way from home. What you doing here?
Yeah.
And, just driving through. And he's like, what'd you do while you were here? And I said, it's Beale Street. He's like, oh, shit, walking in Memphis. You know, and it was just, it was really funny.
You know? Was it Mark Cohn?
It was not Mark Cohn.
Okay, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. But I will tell you that Beale Street was a blast. And I got some photos of that. I haven't taken them off my camera. Hot. Wouldn't probably drive across country in August again. Not going that route.
It's not that. Yeah. If you're going to do that, you got to go north, right? But even north, it's hot. I think the fall is the time to do the long drives. That's what Conrad and I have learned over the years.
Right. But it was, it was a blast. And I'm, we'll get to the why, because there are some questions asking why here, why now.
There's a few questions for you in the stack.
In the stack, right.
So but are we popping the stack? Is that the correct term?
I think it is. Yeah, okay. But I'm thrilled to be here, and lots of stuff on the horizon, and I can't wait to dig in. The last of my stuff should be here. My bike should be here today. It is on the FedEx truck for delivery, and the last of my books. Hey, I got to tell you something. Here's a little tip.
Just shipped yourself media mail.
Right. This is the tip in media mail. It is a great deal. So thank you, U.S. Postal Service, for this. Because, for example, if you send a 15-pound box, okay, like one of the boxes was, this was a lighter box, 15 or so pounds, and it was $39 and change, let's say. And the lady asked, you know, is there anything hazardous, da, 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 you know, what, lithium batteries, whatever. And I said, no, it's just books. And she said, oh, it's books. I said, yeah. And she's like, oh, well, we can send it media mail. So from $38 to $9, Bill.
Now, what actually is the rules for media mail? Like you were saying, if it was books and you threw a couple t-shirts in there.
And if they find out, then they bill
that's
you
a problem?
For the entire amount. Yeah.
True.
Even to the point of if you're sending somebody books, I mean, if you look on the U.S. Postal Service website, even if you send like a little thank you note in there, they consider that breaking the rules. It's books, CDs, DVDs, pre-recorded CDs, not blanks.
Right.
So there are some caveats to it, but, you know.
Are they really going to open up your stuff to look?
I don't know, and yeah. I didn't want to take that chance because now I'm not there to get it. So yeah. I followed the rules. It was books and packing material, and I ended up sending 13 or 14 boxes of books.
Wow!
But it was quite a savings. So again, thanks to the U.S.
The media
Postal
mail.
Service. Yeah, that's the hot ticket there.
The hot ticket from 1902.
Right. That I just found. Well, you know.
All right. Where do you want to start? At the beginning?
We might as well. Take a deep breath. Get a drink of water.
All right. Let's get this here.
I've just had my iced coffee, so I feel good about that.
All right. Well, the first one is for you. You ready?
The first one is for me.
Yeah. Harold Kachekmeyer. Would Jeffrey say my full name in his French accent?
Oh,
and he has his first name here, his full name here. Do you
full
see
name.
This?
All right. Christopher Harold Philippe Kachekmeyer.
Perfect. There you go.
Is that okay? What do you think?
Yeah. I think that's great.
Philippe Kachekmeyer. I don't know.
That's the guy's new, you've reached Christopher. Right. Okay.
Hey, if you didn't, I'll send this to you offline, but Patrick is friends with Dan Castellaneta.
Okay.
Who is the voice of Homer Simpson. And if you call Patrick's cell phone, his message is Homer.
Oh, that's useful.
Yeah.
So, that's just silly.
Pat's not around. He's out messing around, you know?
Yeah.
And Patrick then comes in and goes, hey, what are you doing? And Homer's like, shh, I'm screening your calls. You said you didn't ever want to talk to beep. And then it beeps.
That's pretty funny.
Great. Yeah, it's genius.
Number two, you want to take this one?
How would you start your photography business with the resources of a high school student? Okay, so question. Creative resources, financial resources, gear resources? What are we talking about here?
I'm assuming he means financial resources, right?
Okay.
But I guess the question then becomes, what exactly do you think you need that you don't already have? Right. I mean, like, I could see, like, if you don't have a camera, obviously that's a problem. But, like, assuming you own a camera, you know, is it, oh, I want to buy lights and I don't have any money.
Type of photography? Are you a wedding shooter? Are you a fine art shooter?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that nowadays, I think the whole idea of a photography business easier to set up because, you know, get a Squarespace site or, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, and put your work up there and you know, get a cell phone or whatever it is and you're kind of in business, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you want to be an Instagram photographer, you literally, you know.
You just need your phone.
Right.
So I guess that's a good question. I mean, if you want like a more deep answer, I mean, credit cards are a bad idea. If you can borrow money from your parents, if you need to actually buy something, that's probably a better way to go.
Would you say there is a minimum level of camera and not in terms of image quality, because image quality is superb on pretty much any camera you can buy right now.
Yep.
But in maybe in terms of
perception,
reliability, robustness. Yeah. I mean, it depends. Is there something that you'd suggest that way?
It depends. It's interesting. It depends on again, like you said, like what kind of photography you're doing. I spent a few hours last night with a couple like high end wedding photographers, and they had all their gear there, and I was just asking. I was like, you know, you guys like really beat on your. I mean, they're using their stuff 10 times more than I use my stuff. You know, they're just like beating on it. And the guy was just like, yeah, I slam my lenses into walls all the time, like accidentally, you know, when I'm turning around and the, you know, he's just like, every once in a while, we just have to replace stuff, you know? But most of the time it's pretty hardcore, and that's why you buy the pro stuff, 'cause it can handle the knocks better. But I mean, but as far as the rest of it goes, I mean, you know, unless you're that guy, and if you're that guy, then you're making a lot of money and you could buy the fancier gear. So I would say no. I mean, if you have a Rebel with a kit lens, I think you're pretty much good to go. I mean, you know, buy yourself an Alien Bees for $229 or whatever the hell they are. And you could start shooting with lights, you know?
Sure.
So
you can get some of the young Nuo speed lights if you want to go lighter and smaller. Yeah. Those are terrific.
So Perrin, if you have a specific question, just email us and we could probably give a better answer. Christopher Williams recently purchased a flash modifier for my speed light. Was so excited to play with it that when I grabbed my camera, I didn't realize until I hit the neighborhood that I had left my memory card in the reader and all my spares in my camera bag at home. I spent the next few hours snapping shots that only lasted as long as the preview on my LCD screen. I had it set for 4 seconds. It was tremendously freeing to capture moments for mere moments, and I found that I didn't feel any of the tension brought on by self-doubt and internal pressure to get the shot that I usually do while shooting, even for fun. This is a too long prelude, leads to the question: how often, if ever, do you create for only the sheer joy of creation? And how do these times influence your purpose-driven creations or workflow? That's a good question. What do you think?
For me, it's easy. Almost
everything
always.
You do is
for
the
almost
joy of
everything
creation.
Because I don't make a living like you and probably a lot of our listeners do as a photographer. Now, who knows? That may change while I'm here. Now that I'm here, I don't know. I'd like to explore some fine art stuff. I'd like to explore printmaking. I'd like to explore all sorts of different areas of image making. And possibly, I don't know if she's going to have time, but I might be learning wet plate from Joni Sternbach, which is terrific. You know, so I don't know. For you, what would you say?
I will tell you that, I mean, other than the stuff where somebody hires me to, you know, here, go shoot, take pictures of this person for some magazine or whatever it is. I mean, most of the work that I do for me is for the joy of creation. Although it's interesting, as this Christopher Williams seems to be freed by the fact that his stuff isn't going to exist later. And I don't know if that's because he doesn't want to look at it after the fact, like, oh, it looks really good on my screen. So, oh, it looks great. And then maybe when he goes home, it doesn't look as good on his computer because when it's bigger and whatever.
Right. Yeah. Lots of stuff looks good 3 inches across. Right.
Right. And that's when he starts sort of beating himself up. For me, most of the time I have, I like the doing, but the doing sort of leads to the kind of finish, like, ah, look, I have this thing, you know, I'm done.
Right.
Like, I like that completionist kind of feel.
There's the thing to show for the doing.
Yes, exactly. Artifact. Yeah. And so for me, the idea of shooting and then not having anything to show for it, I wouldn't get joy out of that because the joy for me is the doing to completion, you know? But I guess that's just different strokes for different folks, you know? Yeah, it's interesting.
I think at the core, if you are creating, there should be some joy in it.
Yeah. Or whether why else are you
only,
doing it?
Yeah, I mean, why go through the struggle of trying to, you know, sort of meld the act of creation and sort of reconciling that with who you are as a creator, as an artist, whatever. There should be some joy in it.
Yeah.
You know? That way, if it at the very least, you enjoyed going through it.
Yeah. And I think for Christopher, it's like, you know, lighten up. Don't beat yourself up, you know?
Right. Right.
I think it's, you know, I said the other day on that thing with that beard next. I said, you know, so many people look for a style when in reality you have to let go looking for a style in order to find a style. Like, you can't be aiming to find a
style. Just emerge.
Yeah. It emerges organically. Just do the stuff and then you'll look back and you'll find a thing. So it's, Yeah, it's that's interesting. So in answer to your question, I do all the stuff I do sort of out of the joy of creation, but I don't mind looking at it afterwards, you know. And sometimes they don't work out, you know. Sometimes you do something and it's like, yeah, it's good. It's technically correct, but it's not, you know, that it's like, it's okay, but it doesn't do anything that makes me excited, you know.
Sure. Sure.
Let's see.
All right, next one. Justice Pang. Jeffrey mentioned maybe in jest, not in jest, about wanting a new camera. I'm curious how y'all deal with gear lust in a world of limited resources.
Credit cards.
Me,
oh, sorry.
I want more than I get.
Yeah.
I've been wanting a new camera for a long time, but really, I don't need a new camera.
It's very rare when any purchase of gear actually gives you the satisfaction you think you're going to get from it.
Yeah.
At least in my experience.
Yeah. And I think that's been kind of our thing since the beginning of this show is let's talk about some of the other things.
Yeah.
You know, and the people that I really get fuel from, people like David Duchemin.
Right.
Who have been beating the drum forever about it's not about which camera you use. It's not about the glass you use. It's not about, you know,
right.
The pencil, the mic, the brush, the paint, whatever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, what story are you trying to tell?
Yeah.
And how well are you telling that story?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
For example, lately, you know, I use a Canon 5D3 and I've been looking at the new 5DS cause I'd like to have some more megapixels for some more artsy stuff to make big prints. But it's whatever it is, $3,500. Maybe I could sell my current one for 15. So now it's $2,000. It's like, all right, I can almost justify that because I have to spend money to write it off at the end of the year and that kind of thing. You know, I mean, so there are certain things, but like right now it's just like, I don't really need it. I will tell you that buying really good stuff, for example, all of my prime lenses that I've had now for five or six years, I haven't bought a lens. I mean, I bought that little 40mm pancake, just because I had a gift card or whatever it is for $120. But like everything else is all lenses I bought 6 years ago and I haven't replaced them because there's nothing to replace.
Right. Nothing wrong with them.
Yeah. So you buy good stuff that's sort of universal and long lasting and it'll just last for a long time. You know, then you don't have as much gear lust and you probably don't spend as much in the long run as just keep upgrading your stuff all the time. Just if you can afford it, buy the really good stuff to the beginning and then just live with it, you know?
Yep. Yep. Agreed.
This one's me, right? Johnny Elul? How would you pronounce that?
Elul? Sure.
Okay. You're both very driven artists. We are.
Really?
You both seem to get things done. We do?
What show are you listening
We're
to,
getting
Johnny?
We're get it doners, apparently. I'm curious in the what the first 80 minutes of your day looks like. How do you wake up and get your start your engine? Do you have a routine? Do you have coffee before engaging in tactical logistics conversations with your partner? Do you write? I love to know this stuff. You probably have more of a routine, or at least you did a week and a half ago, than I do.
I do. I mean, you know, I get up, I make a shot of espresso, or I'm making a latte or something, and I spend probably the first half hour or so looking at things. I'll go through my Flipboard. I'll go to Apple Trailers. I'll go to Ain't It Cool News to see what's going on in, you know, films and movies. I just start the day with input.
Input being, you know, caffeine.
Well, no. Well, that too. But creative input. You know, I love watching movie trailers. If there's a show that I missed that I wanted to see, maybe I'll watch a little bit of that. Yeah. I just want to get some sort of visual stimulus coming in and then see what the day brings.
Yeah.
Actually, before I do any of that though, I run.
Before you eat, drink coffee or do anything.
Yeah.
But that's a fairly recent thing, right?
That's been a recent addition to the routine. Yeah. I used to run in the afternoon, but I find that if I start the day out, it really does make a difference in my mood. And if I start to spiral, or if I feel like I'm not getting anything done, at least I did something healthy for my body.
Yeah, you did something.
Yeah. Yeah. You?
I don't have as much of a routine because I don't drink coffee. And even lately, I've actually gotten to the point where I drink maybe a can of soda a day. And that's the only sugar drink I drink. In the last couple weeks, I've been feeling chubby. So I was just like, you know what? I got to knock all that out. sometimes I go up the street to the diner and get an egg sandwich or whatever it is. The difference that I mean, I have Conrad here who gets up and goes to a job. So mm-hmm. I end up getting up with her and talking to her in the morning. But like, I don't have a standard thing that I do. And sometimes I think that I would be more, sometimes I get into to times when I get into a cycle and I'm like, okay, this is good. I'm, you know, doing this X times a day or, you know, like that kind right. of thing. But I usually fall out of it. And I figure, you know, at age 40, if that sort of life way of looking at things doesn't stick, then it probably just will never stick. The sort what's of very your, structured thing.
What's your rowing thing? Isn't that every morning? Or is that just kind of whenever the urge strikes
every,
you?
I go almost every day. Mm-hmm. But I usually go, yeah, when I get the chance. Like I was thinking of going this morning and then I was like, oh, well, it's raining. I'll go this afternoon. When we get in kicks sometimes where both of us go to the gym in the morning, like on, you know, get up at 6 or 6:30 and go to the gym. And I do feel better doing that. It's just in the summertime, it's kind of hard for some reason. There's like something about just like the heat of the summer. It's just like, I don't want to go outside, you know, I get lazy. But yeah, it's a good question. I don't really have, much of a routine, but Jeffrey's much more of the, you're much more of the Japanese tea service kind of guy than I am. You know what I mean?
I don't quite know.
Like it's just very particular, very sort of, sort of looking for not routine,
ritual,
ritual. You're more ritualistic than I am.
Okay. I think that's fair. Yeah. Sure.
Let's see.
Okay, you next, Vincent.
Yep.
I see a lot of parallels between audio recording and photography and often see techniques popular in one area that apply equally well to the other. For example, getting as close to the final product as possible during the capture, get it right at the source / get it right in camera, or each, and there are great analog digital debates and rampant gear lust.
True.
One trend I see that I like in audio recording, in the audio recording world, is commitment. People prize analog preamps and EQs and compressors and value the idea of committing to a certain sound on the way in. It avoids pushing all of your decisions to the mix, and many argue offers a faster workflow and better result because you learn to trust your decisions and force yourself to better understand your craft by removing a level of safety net. Wow, Vincent, this is a terrific question. You put a lot of thought into this. Thank you.
Yep.
Can you think of any ways to parallel this idea of making commitments along the way rather than simply shooting raw and leaving a mound of work to be done in post? I've been toying with some ideas, but would love to hear your opinions. What do you got?
Let's see. I mean, you could, well, you could shoot film. that would be one way to do it.
Right.
You could shoot JPEG in cameras. I mean, the problem is that with recording, I mean, if you're recording through a good, like that's my old world, Vincent. I went to Berkeley for recording, so I used to do this, a lot of this stuff. But if you're recording straight to tape going through compressors and EQs and stuff, you're going through the same compressors and EQs and stuff that you would use in the mix often. And you're just sort of like deciding that that's what it's going to be and putting it to tape that way, printing it that way, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. In photography, it's a little harder because the tools you have inside of your camera are not nearly as powerful as the tools that you have, say, in Lightroom or similar software. If they were, I would say, sure, absolutely. Sort of just print straight to a flat JPEG, you know, and do it that way, which is actually what I did a lot when I had my Fuji. Do you shoot RAW with your Fuji or you just shoot JPEG?
A lot of times I'll shoot JPEG because the JPEGs that come out of the
are fantastic.
X-Pro are gorgeous.
Yeah, and they were in the X100S too. So I would do that. I mean, the other option is to use like a RAW software, but come up with the sort of style that you like, you know, and have that added on import. Just don't mess with it too much, you know.
Or shoot RAW plus JPEG, and then you've always got a backup. You've got the JPEG flat out of camera.
Yeah.
But then if you do want to play with it, shoot RAW plus JPEG.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of, for example, like a lot of the stuff that I end up doing as composites could be done real, you know, like in fact, I was reading for some reason I was looking at Netflix and watching the beginning of Mission Impossible 2 yesterday, where Tom Cruise
Which one
is on.
Was two?
Tom Cruise, it's the one with Thandi Newton.
Oh, right.
And
right.
Yeah. That's her name? Thandi? Something like that. Beautiful woman.
I think it's Tandy. I don't think you pronounce
it. Tandy? Is it?
I don't
anyway.
I think.
Whatever, that beautiful woman. And in the beginning, it's like him in Utah, like climbing the giant rock face, and he almost falls. And
oh,
remember
right,
that scene?
Right, yeah. right, right.
And apparently, you know, they did similar to they did in the new one where he's hanging off the plane, where they have him tied in and then they digitally remove the wire, you know, so that it looks like he's just hanging there. It's like you could do that stuff in stills, and a lot of people do, where instead of hanging somebody off the thing, I have them hang off something lower and then composite the two together, just because I don't have the means to do the thing in camera that I'd like to do in camera.
Sure.
So sometimes it's like a necessity. Other times it is trying to make decisions, right? And for those people, yeah, shoot JPEG. You know, try it for a week. Especially if it's not like for a client or something that's going to, oh, if you screw up, money's on the line or reputation's on the line.
Right.
Like try limiting yourself. And a lot of these cameras, like I know on the Canon cameras, like not only can you go in and set up user things of saturation and color shift and all that kind of stuff.
Like a custom profile type thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. But you can also like sideload them in to the camera. I've done that for a few. There's sort of some cine profile looking things, you know, some sort of flat log kind of looking stuff for video that I've put onto my camera too. So you might want to look into that because there might be some of those that are good. But I mean, yeah, it's a lot of people don't like making decisions, you know, and a lot of people like Millie further down complains about spending time in Lightroom. And it's like, I don't mind spending time with my pictures after I take them because I see that as a part of the creating the photograph, like spending time in the darkroom. Like, but in, as we know, like people like Cartier-Bresson never went in they hated the darkroom. So they just handed it off to other people, you know? So I guess it's just a different way of looking at it. But I agree that people spend way too much time not making decisions. I think it's easier to sort of, the audio side of that is actually slightly easier than the photo side of it to make happen. But maybe they'll do that as DSPs get better in cameras and we can start putting in more curves and adjustments and things. So you could just say, no, this is how I want it. You
right.
know, give me a nice flat file.
Right.
Or 16-bit TIFF.
You know, apply that sort of S curve to everything and give me that little bump in contrast, little punch in the highlights and the shadows.
And I know a lot of people who do that. Like Jay Mazel famously likes to shoot JPEG. His studio people, like the kids in his studio, make him shoot JPEG in RAW, but all he wants the RAW for is the team wants the RAW. He wants the JPEG. They make him shoot RAW because they think the image quality is better. But basically, the people just sit there, try to make the RAW match the JPEG because he wants the JPEG is the reference.
Nice.
So some people are into that, you know, just the way it depends on how you look at it. Let's see. God, how would you pronounce that name?
Tsitsi Zylstra.
Wow. Nice.
Is that fair? That's probably pretty good.
Yeah, that was actually really good. I wouldn't have been able to do that.
Maybe that's wrong, and I apologize, but...
I think that that's probably fine.
You know we're bad at the names. If you've been listening to 172 episodes, you know we screw up the names.
You know who's really upset at us?
Who?
Robert Doisneau.
Robert Doisneau.
He's long dead, isn't he?
Stéphane Louveau.
Hey, Stéphane. Okay,
yeah,
here we go.
Home listening.
we all right. So here's a bunch of quick questions, which I think we have answered before, but we can give the quick roundups.
Yep.
This guy hasn't been listening for all 172 episodes. What have you been doing with your time?
That's right. Go back and listen.
Number one, how did we meet? When was it? So what was that? 2009?
2009 or 10. Yeah. I saw, actually Nikki turned me on to your work and reached out, asked if you would want to have a conversation. You did. And we hit it off, and I think anyway
that was a Q&A at FMB, right?
Yeah. And then over the next, gosh, it was probably a year and a half, we had talked on the phone several times about maybe wanting to do something.
Yeah.
This kind of leads into question two: how and when did you come up with the idea of the podcast?
Wait, I think he actually says there that wait, one last thing he says, where is it, how did your friendship evolve? That assumes that we are friends, which
right?
Yeah, I don't think so. Ooh, awkward.
Acquaintances.
All right, sorry. Number two. When did you come up with the idea of doing the podcast? I had been doing a podcast with my friend Dan Gottesman. Jeffrey had been doing the Q&A podcast, and Dan Benjamin at 5x5 suggested that I do a show called On Taking Pictures. And so I said, Jeffrey, you want to do the show with me? And that's pretty much how it ended up. Is that a fairly reasonable thing?
Yeah, the first episode was kind of...
trial balloon.
The audition.
Yeah. How and when did you decide to really go through with it? Well, we just kind of threw ourselves into it, as with anything good in life. What are the obstacles you had to overcome? Getting Jeffrey up early enough to record at 6 a.m.
Oh, come on. No.
What was your aim, and has it changed over time? That's a good question.
I don't know that we did have a name. I don't know, because
it was never a gear thing.
Mm-mm.
It was more how the second half of our show now is sort of the little news chunks. It was more that, and then we started getting into the larger philosophical conversations that just kind of happened, you know?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
In episode 111, you guys talk about coming to the Netherlands. Is that still part of your plans? Eventually, I'd like to go to the Netherlands.
I would love to see the Netherlands, sure.
In fact, I was thinking we were actually considering doing that for our honeymoon in the fall. I've been wondering this for a while, but I always forget to ask. Should I actually answer this question?
Yeah.
What do you guys have against Trey Radcliffe? I don't mean to defend him or anything. I'm just curious. His name comes up in some of the episodes, and you don't seem to have enthusiastic about his workers' activities. I've never caught an explanation as to why, though.
We have anything. I just don't like ham-fisted HDR.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
That's pretty much it.
And I don't really understand how he's ended up becoming the poster child for like all things photographic in some worlds.
Right.
Also, that seems a little odd. I'm sure he's a very nice guy personally.
He seems great. He seems really terrific. But, you know, just that whole like overly processed.
Yeah.
He's
sort of the poster child for that. So that's the only reason we say stuff. It's not personal. It's
that Arcanum thing, which seems kind of.
Which thing was that?
You know, the levels. It's like your masters and you're learning.
Oh, that crap. Yeah.
It's like Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
For,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. Weird. That was like episode 80.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure people are learning from it and it's great, but it seems like an Amway thing to me. I don't know.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. I would go there. Next one is yours.
James Haddock.
Actually, you actually answered kind of this already, but go ahead.
Highest and lowest gas cost for the trip. Worst meal, best shot you missed.
Was Texas the cheapest gas?
Somewhere
around there?
No, probably Memphis. I think it was $2.15.
Okay.
$2.13, something like that. Yeah. Worst meal. Worst meal. Didn't really have a bad meal. No, didn't really. The best meal was the barbecue in Nashville.
Can't go wrong with good barbecue.
What's it called? I told you.
Oh yeah, you did. Sally Ann's
Peg leg porker.
Peg leg porker.
I am not a coleslaw person. I never have been.
But it was good slaw.
Can't stand it. It was fantastic, and it's on the sandwich.
Oh yeah,
like a pulled pork sandwich.
Like a pulled pork sandwich with slaw. That's the classic. Yeah.
Oh, it's terrific. Yeah. And the baked beans and then smoked green beans.
Yeah. That's dangerous right there.
It was good. And the guy next to me was eating a rack of dry rub ribs that looked and some mac and cheese. Oh, geez.
Dry rub always reminds me of the West Wing.
Yeah, so good. So good. Best shot I missed?
Yeah.
Probably a lot because I didn't stop very many places for any length of time. It was like gas, meal, go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And Nick wants to know how many Waffle Houses you visited.
Just one in Memphis.
Okay. They're not bad, actually.
It was great. Served by a girl named Alyssa, who was very great. There's kind of a knockoff to the Waffle House called the Omelet Shack.
Really? I've never seen that. That was like middle of the country?
Virginia, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's Omelet Shack, but same kind of block letters, very similar logos, same kind of logistics where you've got the grill in the center and then the seating as kind of a horseshoe around it.
It's amazing how fast they make those waffles. Pretty impressive.
It was good. It was very good.
Freddie asks, how much show prep did it take for you to both know that David Ortiz was a baseball player? A lot, actually, because I vaguely knew the name. That's the best I can do.
Right.
Sorry, Freddie. Max, what do you got?
Max Nex. How about Jeffrey taking along a GoPro camera stuck on the dashboard of his car, recording the cross country via time lapse?
Did you ever consider anything like that?
No, I don't have a GoPro.
You could have had your phone do it, theoretically.
Could have, yeah.
Stick it up on a little mount on the windshield.
It would have been really boring.
A whole lot of flat horizon.
Yeah, it would have been really boring.
Maybe through the mountains or something. That would be fun.
Yeah, but it was hard to tell the difference between
up and down
Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas on the 40. They're very similar. It's just sort of flat expanse as far as you can see.
Yeah. Jeff Green, since it's been brought up several times in the podcast, I feel like I'm not really a photographer until I've seen it. I picked up a copy of Frank's The Americans. I read Jack Kerouac's introduction, but afterwards I was struck by how little Frank says about each of the photographs. Just a title, location being it if you're lucky. Do you think it's necessary or important for a photographer to include this information to give details about each photo, or just let the picture stand on its own? I'm not saying a photographer has to write a whole art school pretense essay, but a couple lines can add a whole new dimension to the photo. Nor should a mediocre photo be supported by flowery prose.
Can I just say how much I love that the phrase art school pretense has become like a vernacular, you know, for
I think we should start shortening it as ASP.
ASP.
I'm going to get a little ASP right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, here's the thing. We have gone on both sides of the, with a nice little label explaining it, it becomes so much more. And we've also gone to the other extreme, which is, no, just leave the picture. It's just a freaking picture. Stop trying to explain it. And I think that they are two very different things. I think that ultimately photography is an abstract art form as much as people want it to be something else. You know, that what you see in the frame, if you don't explain it, could mean any number of, you know, any myriad of things, right? And I think that putting a label on there is an artistic or not putting it on or explaining a long label is an artistic choice that is part of the photograph itself in many ways.
I would say that's true, or it can be true.
Yeah. So
it's not true in every case, but I do think it can be true. Sure.
Yeah. I don't think it's necessary. Sometimes I like just seeing a picture for what it is. Oh, it's just a picture. I don't care that it was taken in Arizona, in this place, at this angle, at this time of day, by this person. You know, sometimes the details don't matter, or the fact that the guy just got in a fight with his wife or whatever it is before he took
the
picture.
More photo, less providence of the photo type thing. Okay.
You know, maybe those things are important for certain photos, but I think that making that decision is a part of the holistic idea of taking that picture in the first place. You know, like whether or not to share those details is part of taking the photo or part of sharing the photo.
Do you think that should be in the purview of the photographer, or in the case of a gallery or a museum, the curator of the collection?
I think if it's a historical photograph, it should be up to the curator. I think if the guy or girl is still alive, then it should be up to the photographer. I think that, I mean, I've read, I don't know if I read all of Jack Kerouac's introduction, but I've heard chunks of it. And that in itself is flowery prose, right? Because he's Jack Kerouac. He's speaking in, you know, riddles half the time, you know?
Right, right.
So it's interesting. It's like, you know, what are you getting out of his introduction? Well, that's a whole other way to spin the photographs by having a guy like that talk about them. Yeah. I don't know if it's necessarily important, but it's something some people do and some things some people don't do. And I think the people who do or don't do have reasons for doing it or not doing it. Got anything
else?
Agreed.
Nope. That's good.
Justice?
Yeah, this is kind of an addendum. Justice looked up funny. The Americans at his library. The whole Las Vegas Clark County library system has one copy. However, it has 171 copies of The Expendables 3 on DVD.
That's about right.
Right. Yeah. It feels like that works. You want to just do the Millie one?
Yeah, sure.
Is the amount of pictures that you take inversely proportional to the amount of time you hate to spend in Lightroom? I'm getting to love hate Lightroom.
I don't mind. I mean, I don't take, you know, those wedding photographers last night, they were telling me that they delivered 1,250 pictures to some client recently, and the person got back to them and asked them if they have any more.
Right. Because he didn't quite get what we were after.
And I said, how many did you take? And he said about 5,000.
Oh my gosh.
And so for somebody like that, and I said, when you're going through them, is it yes, no, yes, yes, no? He's like, no, it's faster than that.
It's and, just click, 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 yep. click, click.
Yep. Yeah. And so like for me, you know, I was taking pictures of them last night and it was, I took 200 pictures, but it was to build a whole thing out of like a composite. So I needed a bunch of pictures, but like, that's a lot of pictures for me. And I go through like, sometimes some beautiful woman will come over and I'll take pictures of her and I'll take more pictures than I normally take. And I'll be like, oh my God, I have 450 photos to go through. To me, that feels like a monumental mountain to climb to like, just go next.
Yeah.
Next,
can you imagine next. Going through 5,000 yeah, for a through, shoot yeah, that you've got to turn around in a couple days?
Yeah. A whole, cause you got another shoot that weekend for sure. another, you know, so, I think, you know, sometimes it's limiting your stuff and if you don't like doing the Lightroom thing, do what we said up top, you know. Doesn't Millie shoot with a Fuji?
I think she shoots with an Olympus OM, what is it?
Okay.
EM5, OM5.
Yeah. I just, it's like so start making decisions in camera and just don't, you know, use Lightroom for archiving.
Shoot film.
Yeah, or shoot film, which is complicated and expensive, but yes. Millie also asked, which movie should I see for half price today, Tuesday?
I want to see The Man from U.N.C.L.E., although based on
I can't imagine that has good reviews. Does that have good
probably
reviews?
Probably not. I also want to see Straight Outta Compton, but based on his interview with Marc Maron, I would love to see Bateman in The Gift. Jason Bateman, super cool guy.
Interesting. I would have said the end of the tour. The David Foster Wallace movie?
Not really an interest in seeing it.
Oh, see, I don't know.
I like him, but I just don't know if I can if
he
I can
was supposed
get
to
past
be amazing
Jason
in
Siegel.
It.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's supposed to be good in it. Jeff Green, Jeffrey,
also
was there
Mr. Holmes? I want to see Mr.
Oh,
Holmes.
That's supposed to be very good too.
Yeah.
Was there a moment on your cross country trip where that was particularly memorable or eye opening? You got anything else to add to that, or have you said everything you need to say?
I think just the sheer vastness of America.
Yeah, America. Is that just your first time driving like those areas?
Yeah. Once we I think once you leave basically Grand Canyon is the furthest I've personally driven.
Okay.
So anything past you know, that part of, you know, going into New Mexico and anything east of that, I've never driven that.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, you gotta realize we're talking about a giant country.
Yeah.
And you don't get the sense of scale unless you're driving it, unless you're spending, you know, 7-8 hours where the topography really doesn't change and you go, holy shit, this is really big.
Yeah.
This is really big.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
like also seeing going from the desert and all of a sudden you're like, you're sitting there and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Now we're in the plains. Like it just kind of changes. Like,
yeah,
there's just a transition that you almost don't even notice sometimes. And you're like, oh, now we're in mountains. Wait, when did that happen? You know,
there was a funny moment. I don't know how memorable or sort of, you know, important or whatever, but it was pretty funny. On Beale Street in Memphis, in this
walking in Memphis.
My feet were 10 feet off of Beale.
Yeah.
Walked into a record store, and I had my Fuji out and just kind of wandered around, and the owner comes up to me and he says, hey, what kind of camera is that? And I said, it's a Fuji X-Pro. And he's like, may I see it? I said, sure. So I handed it to him. And he's like, you mind if I take a couple shots? I said, no, go ahead. So he's fiddling around with it and shooting. And he's looking at the back of the camera. He's like, wow. He's like, the bokeh on this lens is just terrific. And it was kind of funny because that's a term that...
Bokeh.
Yeah. I mean, it's a term that if you're a photographer, you've probably heard. Maybe you even use it. But it was just so... not surprising, not out of place, but it just kind of took me back a little bit that here I am in the, you know, this record shop in Memphis and this guy's talking about bokeh, you know, and he's going on to, it's like, wow, it's, you know, it's really, I love how, you know, smooth and blah, blah, blah. And, so we just ended up sitting there having a conversation about photography. His name's Malcolm, terrific guy and owner of the shop. And so that was kind of interesting. Also met another guy named Jerome Pullum, who has a record called the Pullum Project, He just did a single with the lead singer of a band called the Barkays. Remember them from back in the day?
No, but go ahead.
Kind of a soul band from the 70s. Sat and talked to him about music in this little club where this guy was, you know, single guitar, just kind of over on stage playing the blues. And, and it was just little
sounds
moments.
Sounds like True Detective.
Like, kind of, yeah. You know, stuff like that. But nothing that really stuck out because of its sort of intrinsic value or anything. I didn't have sort of an aha moment, but there were just little vignettes. There were little moments sort of dappled along the trip that I really enjoyed.
Well, what there's also a second question for both of us. What road trips have been important to you, photographic or not? I will tell you that I went on a trip with my father. My father and I didn't get along very well for much of my life, and I gave him a copy of the Persig book, the Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, 2003. I guess it was Christmas of 2003, and my father actually read it, and he was not a reader, and he called me up one day. He's like, we should take a road trip like this. So instead of getting on a motorcycle, we got a car in Minneapolis and drove all the way to the West Coast to where the book ends, and then all the way down through Yosemite and Death Valley, and all the way up through Utah to Denver, and then flew out over 14 days. And so it's interesting, you know, your whole high, low gas prices.
Right.
Lowest gas price on our trip was in Colorado, $1.99 a gallon. Highest gas price was $3.09 at Death Valley. Now, remember, this is 2004.
Right.
$3 gas was like, you know, $6 gas now.
Yeah. Highest gas price on the trip was when I left, and it was
It's that much in California?
409 or 413, something like that.
Yeah, just enough to get over to Arizona.
Yeah, right.
And so I will put a link to the show notes, actually, because there is the little chronicles that I took pictures on that trip. So as a road trip, that was it. But like Conrad and I take a lot of trips out west where we fly in somewhere, drive around to national parks, and end up in another city and fly out. So those are always great. You have any other road trips for you?
Probably the one I remember the most that had the most impact on me. We were coming back from Lake Havasu. I must have been 9 or 10, maybe.
Yeah.
And we're driving back, towing the boat. My father's 1974 Ford F-100 short bed.
Yeah.
We threw a rod, so had to pull over. The bad news. It was my stepmother Linda, me, and my dad, and we were out in the middle of nowhere
with Chud
somewhere. You know, nowhere, Arizona.
Yeah.
And you know, this is obviously pre-cell phone or pre any kind of phone. And my dad said, I've got to hitchhike into town, see if I can get a ride into town and, you know, get a tow truck and come back and get us. And he took his gun, his 357 Ruger Blackhawk, which was in its holster. And
like you had to protect yourself with a gun? Were you actually worried, or he was just being...
He gave it to me and said, don't let anything happen to mom.
Wow. What, how old are you?
Probably 10.
Wow.
It's like, you're in charge here. And
heavy.
And so here I am 10 years old and I've got this hand cannon in my lap. It was one of the first times that I remember my dad trusting me or depending on me in some way. One of the only times that I've ever felt that, actually.
Right.
I've never forgotten it. And I still have his gun. That's, you know, it'll never be fired, but I have it because of that memory. It ties me to that memory.
That's a good story.
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah.
Maybe we should take a break right now.
I think so.
And talk about Squarespace. You want to talk about Squarespace? You want me to talk about Squarespace? You like it when I talk about Squarespace.
You know what? I will tell you this about the Squarespace. Yeah. I have been noticing more and more people
using
Squarespace professionally. I'm talking about not just, you know, oh, I want to build a site and I want to, you know, I want to do this, that, and the other. But I've noticed more and more either creative professionals or just businesses using Squarespace because they realize all the things that you're going to say in just a minute. They've realized that. It is drag and drop. It is easy to use. It is user-friendly, and it is beautiful and scalable and all of those things that we talk about. But I just think it's terrific that it's not just sort of in a vacuum of podcast sponsorship, that it people really are using it.
No,
really
restaurants, artists. Yeah. It's crazy.
So, and anyway, what do you got?
Well, you're right. It is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. I mean, that it's funny. That statement is, you know, advertising hyperbole to some, but not is actually true.
It's hyperbole until you look at the admin tool and you go, oh.
Oh, I can actually figure this out.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's also nice not have to worry about the software underneath it all, to know it's getting updated without me doing anything because it's all on this like platform that I don't have to think about. Mm-hmm. It's simple, it's powerful, it's beautiful. The people at Squarespace have 24/7 support via live chat and email. And for only $8 a month, you can get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a year. So like their low-end price, $8 a month, you can't go wrong. They got responsive design, so your website looks great all the way down to an iPhone or on your iPad or on a Android device. I wonder how it looks on an Apple Watch. Is there a browser on the Apple Watch yet?
You know what? I have no idea. I don't know if there is.
Yeah,
I think they have a new template. Is Fulton? Have we seen Fulton before?
I don't know that I've seen Fulton. So yeah, send me a link. Every website comes with a free online store, so you have commerce built in. And this new cover pages feature that allows you to build a simple, beautiful one-page online presence in minutes. So if you just need a place for people to go to get your address and your phone number and your contact information and that kind of stuff, easy. It's right there. And you can also use that to set up, oh, I got a new album dropping. So I'm going to, you know, stick up.
Did you really just use that?
I did. This cover page, you know, like, hey, the new album's here. If you want to learn more, like, click here. You want to go to the main website? Click there. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you could start your trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. So go over to Squarespace, and when you decide to sign up, make sure you use the offer code OTP to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for On Taking Pictures. We thank Squarespace very much for supporting 5x5 and Not Taking Pictures. Squarespace, build it beautiful. They're good people. They have a good product, and we really like them. All right. You ready to dive back in? You need to take a drink or something? You need to change your diaper?
Hold on. Nope.
You want this one?
Tim Lewis, what is the best photography-related advice you guys have received, and why did that advice prove so valuable?
You're the best around.
No one's ever gonna get you down. It might be Bring You Down.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, I think it was Bring You Down.
So Eric Roberts, right?
Eric Roberts, what, sang that?
No. In the movie, wasn't it Best of the Best? Wasn't it the
no,
fighting
that's,
movie?
No, that's from Karate Kid.
That's right.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Sweep the leg.
Best photography-related advice you guys have ever received. When I first started out doing this professionally, a friend of a friend whose name I can't remember now because I only talked to him once on the phone was a professional photographer, and a buddy of mine hooked me up with having a conversation with him on the phone. And he was telling me just about the business and the whole thing. And one of the pieces of advice he gave me that has proved useful was just like, he said, you know, if you start making money, just put it away because it's not going to last forever. Like basically, like if you suddenly get some big gig where you're making $100,000 in a few weeks, like don't think that that's going to last forever and blow your money on a fancy car and a house that you can't afford if it doesn't stay around. And it's interesting because my career, and I think most people's careers, do go in very sort of almost sine wave like dips and you know, highs and lows.
Mm-hmm.
And so him telling me that, I remember that being, oh yeah, yeah, sure. But it's exactly what's happened to me like over the years. Like sometimes I'll get a big gig and I'll make a bunch of money and then nothing will happen for months, you know, and it'll be right, glad I didn't spend that money. So I think that's my best photography related advice. Although that advice goes for any business or anything, like a lot of things in life, you know, moderation, you know. You have any good advice?
Not really. Not photography related. I mean, creative advice has just, gosh, I don't know. Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough one. Next question. Nicholas Govis. How would you pronounce that? Yeah, that's right.
Nicholas Govis, sure.
I can use my cell phone camera to take fine pictures. I just don't like using it very much. I think the user interface is poor next to my next to any purpose built camera. How do you guys feel about this issue given the ubiquity of cell phone cameras? Are you using any amazing apps that improve the user experience in your phone camera? Do you think a user interface breakthrough is coming? Or are you going to be tapping and swiping, trying to lock focus and change exposure, and then tapping and re-swiping for the next 10 years?
I don't see the interface moving around that much. But then again, that's not my job. And if I could, I'd probably, you know, work for Apple or something.
That was a pretty big shift, though, the whole touchscreen picture thing. I mean, to the point where most people who use little cameras are now looking at the screen on the back and not looking through some sort of viewfinder. And there's a lot of touchscreens on the backs of cameras and whatnot.
If I'm just doing simple shots that I'm just, you know, I want to do simple, nice shots. I don't want to do anything to them later. I've been using, this app called Obscura, which is actually written by a listener of the show, Ben Rice McCarthy. I like it. I like the filters. I like how simple it is. I also use, an app called, let's see, where is it? ProShot. That's a real nice one. A lot of control, a lot of manual control, manual exposure control, manual focus control. Like that quite a bit. And then for processing, I've been using two, Photograph and Nlight. Nlight is pretty amazing. And then still some VSCO in there, but those are the ones that I use the most.
Yeah, I will tell you that 99% of the time I use the built-in camera app. Mostly because you can get to it straight from the lock screen.
Right, right.
And for most of the stuff that I'm taking that I'm sticking on wherever, Instagram or whatever, like in Instagram, I'll use the little custom stuff to make changes to it, you know, saturation, shadows, that kind of stuff. But I don't really use the built-in looks, I guess, filters all that often. I will tell you that... I used to dislike cell phone photography more than I have recently, in the sense that especially if I had a new camera, like I plan to get the new one whenever it comes out in September or whatever it is, because mine's an old 5. And I will tell you that the difference between the 5 and the 6, as far as image quality goes, is night and day from what I've seen. I've played with the 6 on a 6 Plus, and it was pretty fantastic. I don't know. Yes, I agree that the whole tapping and all that kind of stuff probably isn't the fastest, most ideal way of doing it. If your other option is some sort of dedicated controls and that kind of thing, of course not.
Although you do have, rumor has it anyway, it hasn't been released, but rumor has it the next one will have Force Touch. So that may open up some different interface opportunities.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that would be interesting. I don't know. The Force Touch on the trackpad freaks me out. I think it's cool, but cool tech, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how people actually use it. Because it's definitely not sort of a standard thing yet, you know, much like right clicking and stuff.
And for those of you who don't know what that is or haven't heard of it before, basically it can detect, pressure, that you're pressing on the glass.
I think what it's really doing is just detecting the spot getting wider because you're pressing and so more of your surface of your finger is touching. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if it's actually...
But then what if you have big, gigantic fingers.
Well, yeah, but when you press it down, you have one thing, but when you push harder, it spreads out. I'm thinking that's actually what it's measuring, as opposed to actually measuring force. See what I'm saying?
Yep.
Like, I think it's a trick. But anyway, it's cool tech. Next one. Julian, you got this one?
Julian Winslow, how do you see photography moving forward? Do you think it might parallel painting's evolution and move towards a more abstract expression? If so, could that parallel be borne out as a result of the digital environment and the cross-pollination of media?
I thought this was a great question.
It is a great question.
We have no idea.
I mean, you know, if we go back to that memory of time exhibit that we talked about a couple of weeks ago,
yep.
A lot of what was on display, or what's, I think it's still going. So a lot of what's on display is analog. It's going back to older methods or creating some sort of hybrid between analog and digital. Yeah.
But I also it is, but I also felt that it felt like it wasn't like they were doing that because they didn't know where else to go forward. So they were kind of like looking backward, like, did we miss something? Mm-hmm. You know, when you're in like a maze game and you get to the end and you hit a door you can't find, you're like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to have another key. Oh shit. I must have missed a key back there somewhere.
Yeah.
I feel like photography is somewhere in there right now. Where we haven't figured out where we missed a key back, so people are looking back to see if that's where it is. I think the abstract expressionist concept is an interesting one because it's much easier for painting to do that because photography is what's in front of the lens, right? Unless mm-hmm. you do crazy stuff to it after the fact. So yeah, maybe when I first read this, I was like, no. And then I started thinking about people, you know, like you doing like the mixed media stuff and all that kind of stuff. So like a digital version of mixed media. Is that where photography ends up going?
You've got people like Uta Bart who are doing a lot of abstraction. You've got Kochi Hernandez who is doing, you know, he's processing and affecting and double exposing and reprocessing and affecting most of his stuff on his iPhone and creating some really interesting work. I think there will always be a place for abstraction. I think there will always be a place for straight documentary photography. I think that in terms of where it will go moving forward it'll be determined largely by the common aesthetic.
Yeah.
But there will still be, you know, fringe and subcultures and things that are outside the norm. Maybe those things will swap places. Maybe they will. You know, who knows?
Yeah. I think culture in general has sort of fragmented mm-hmm. in the last 10 years. And that's led to sort of like these small dominions of different things that certain people think are important. You know, if you're inside the hip hop world, hip hop feels like everything. If you don't listen to hip hop, I have no idea who the latest cool people are in hip hop, you know?
Right.
It's just not my thing. So like, I think that that's happening more. The days of people like Michael Jackson selling 40 million copies of Thriller in America because everyone had a copy of Thriller doesn't exist anymore, right? So it's like these small little fiefdoms, creative fiefdoms. And I think the same thing is going to happen in photography where there's going to be people who are really into the HDR and people who are really into the abstract expressionism and, you know, and I think it might end up going that way.
Interesting. Yeah. Who knows?
Sorry, I'm just putting a little thing up top. Okay, where were we?
Mo Morgan.
This one's for you, but I'll ask it. I'd like to ask a question to Jeffrey. Ask the question Jeffrey put to Doug in the radio studio. As the smoke detector starts to wail, what's the thing you grab before making your escape? Now that you've actually gone through everything you've owned and gotten it down to like a pile and a half.
Right.
Is there one thing that actually means the most to you?
There's a box of photos,
sure,
like family photos, but I mean, anybody would say that.
Yeah.
So maybe beyond family photos, what would I take?
Yeah. Tough.
Yeah. I don't know. The thing that means the most to me, gosh, my phone. That seems kind of random.
Yeah.
No, probably. I mean, in terms of objects, maybe my dad's gun.
Really?
Because of the, yeah, because of the story that we talked about.
Plus, you're going to need to shoot the arsonist.
That's right. Find that little bastard. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I learned, and maybe I knew it for a while, but one of the things that was reinforced was that very few things I own mean anything.
Yeah.
Very, very little of my stuff means anything. And I gave away a ton of stuff. I gave away probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 boxes of books. I gave away furniture. I gave away tools. I gave away, you know, I gave away a ton of stuff.
Right.
And the other than the books that I shipped, if it didn't fit in my car, it didn't come with me.
Right.
And there was a kind of a liberation about that. It was really not freeing, but it made me realize that we tend to value sometimes the wrong things.
Yep. Often.
That there really isn't a lot of value in the stuff that we keep.
Yeah. I personally would grab the little backup hard drive that sits on top of my desk that is the clone of my work drive, you know, like the important stuff. It's like I leave there with that and everything else is replaceable. I mean, there's stuff that's not replaceable. There's a watch from my father. There's, you know, stuff. But like in general, it's like that stuff is just stuff. You know, that doesn't change. Even if you had to leave without that gun and that gun melts into a thing, you still have the memory of that story.
Absolutely.
So, and that's the thing that a lot of people, I think, tend to forget.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peter Evans. All right, we got a couple here. You want to take the first one?
I'll take the first one. You take the second one. All right. First one is, I see a lot of great photography coming from Eastern Europe and Russia without the associated hand wringing over the feeling that everything has been said in photography, that the only things left now are to play with conventions and make big statements. How much do you think is this crisis of, oh, there'll never be another Americans, or no one wants straight photography anymore, actually registered by actual photographers and artists compared to newspaper website articles? Do you think that it is something of a manufactured panic that we've seen everything and there'll be no more great photographers in the classic sense? What do you think?
That's a big question.
It is a big question.
I would say that, yes, there's a lot of great work coming out of Eastern Europe and Russia and everywhere else in the world. You know, the whole, oh, look at this amazing guy named Alexander such and such from Russia or whatever, you know, is on 500 pixels.
Or from Uganda or from...
I don't know that those people are making any money doing it, which is the other question. So is it a thing that there will never be another American? I think that there is a certain amount of American bias or European bias to photography in general, because that's sort of where it was probably the biggest back in the day when Europe and America ruled the world, which they don't now, you know? I don't know. That's a really, is it a manufactured panic? I don't think it's a manufactured panic. And I could see that the thing that always gets me, especially in the last like 20, 30 years, is just the huge ballooning of population in the last, you know, generation. You know, there's twice as many people around. So for everybody who thought was, you know, who you thought was good now, there are 2 or 3 of them taking their place. So at a certain point, you just become overwhelmed by the numbers and 1 or 2 people don't stand out because it's actually 6 or 8 people standing out. And it's harder to point to a singular source.
There's the idea of your aesthetic changing too.
Yeah.
The people that you thought were amazing when you first started, maybe you still think they're good, but maybe as you got better, your bar became not raised or lowered, but it moved.
I do believe though that there is in deference to the answer to the last question where I said that there was all these creative fiefdoms. I do believe that there is in photography, where you come from affects your aesthetic less than it does in some other things. I think there's sort of that we're honing in on some sort of universal way at which people see the world around them with photography. Mm-hmm. Like I don't feel specifically like a Chinese photographer or an Indian photographer or an Ethiopian photographer or a Chilean photographer has such a completely different view of the world around them because of where they grew up. You know what I mean? I think that the internet has caused sort of a homogenization of the look of things in many ways. I don't know if that affects things or not. Man, that's tough.
I tend to like some of the smaller stuff. I tend to like, there's a publisher in East London called Hoxton Mini Press.
Yep.
And they do these little photo books and they're just terrific. And by and large, it's photography that's, you know, based in and around East London. So you've got this small little sort of region, but it's really interesting work and the stories are interesting. And you know, I tend to gravitate towards stuff like that lately.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Number two, two Cockney East End thugs with powerful torches come round to your house at night for incredibly obscure and implausible reasons set about confiscating all of your beloved photography monographs on the orders of the art collecting governor of crime, Bunky Charlie. Laughing off your helpless...
Damn you, Bunky!
Laughing off your helpless pleads in their raucous East End way, which monograph would you quickly hide up your nightshirt? Sorry, I'm bored of the old Your House is on Fire analogies. Is there any particular book, though, that you like couldn't do without?
That I couldn't do without.
Or that you would grab and keep? I mean, I have ones that are more valuable than others, like the Tom Waits book that I have a couple of. But like all of them are just, they're just pictures, you know, in a book.
Gosh. I don't know. I've got a lot of really nice books. There's one called Chasing Dragons that I really like.
But this answer probably changes every 6 months.
Yeah. My giant Rauschenberg book is probably one, although I don't know if I could fit that up my nightshirt, but it's, I like that book a lot.
I like that you actually wear a nightshirt.
Well, you know, sometimes I get chilly.
When you have to go out to the outhouse.
That's right. I've got a giant Frank Lloyd Wright book that I'm really partial to. I like his work. I like the photographs of the houses, and I like seeing his sketches because he was such a beautiful draftsman.
I think I like his sketches more than his finished buildings. But that's a whole other discussion.
Oof, clutch the pearls. You didn't just say that.
Number three. I'm quite surprised. You want to get this one.
I'm quite surprised that there aren't more photography collectives out there. The only one I've met personally is Transit, an incredibly gifted French collective. And the only one I can remember online is the Cage Collective. Do you think that too much emphasis is placed online at being an individual and forging a business and finding your own special sauce rather than trying to form supportive collectives in real life and feed off of each other's creativity? Short answer for me, yes, I do feel that way.
Yeah, me too. But it's interesting because I don't generally think about these collectives.
Isn't the OTP G Plus group, isn't that kind of a collective?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, yeah, you get into a, how do you even define that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is an interesting thing. I mean, the people out there like Magnum back in the day when Magnum was super hot, they were doing it for business reasons as much as creative reasons, right? I mean, the idea of creating creative collectives is an interesting thing. Yes, I think that there should be more of that, but I think that in many ways, less of let's put all our work together and display it as a single entity, and more of let's get together, talk about our work, and then go do our stuff together. Like I'm more interested in the, you know, Pollock at the bar model than the let's put our eggs in one basket together kind of model, personally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll have to do some research about that one. That's a tough one.
There is a collective called Tiny Collective. It's all sort of multimedia.
How many people are in that one?
I don't know. It's tiny. It's all mobile photographers. Cochi Hernandez is part of that.
Oh, well, there you go. Can art truly be considered great art if it remains largely unobserved in a private collection?
Sure.
Sure. Does it not require the power of having the ability to move and inspire and influence an audience? Well, that audience could be two people who are really rich. And when a giant price tag is attached, does it not smother the original value and message inherent in it? So the brain of the owner and the viewer can only think, this costs X amount of dollars. And as art becomes an investment, before the industry collapses in the big budget high art replay of the comic collecting bust, when many men suddenly realized their polybag number ones of meaningless Marvel DC spinoff lines were hilariously both pointless and worthless, only this time with giant Instagram prints with mustaches drawn on it or something. Gasp, long silence, sorry.
We talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of art as an investment rather than an emotional purchase.
I mean, I personally think that art should be shared with other people so other people can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I force people to do that? Is art property? Yes, art is property. You could buy a Van Gogh and stick it up in your house and no one sees it but you because you know the secret code to the secret room where the secret Van Gogh is. Does that make it not great art? It could still be great art. Just someday, hopefully, you'll die and it'll go to someplace where other people can see it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think stuff should be shared, but I don't think it you know. Is there going to be a big crash in the art market? Pff, who knows?
That stuff goes on a long enough timeline, there's a crash in every market.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
sure. Bobby Tingle, how important is it to be able to say no to friends, family, and clients? What are some of the reasons or situations one should say no? When telling somebody no, is it necessary to give a reason why? This is a tough one, actually.
No for what?
I think he's saying, like, if somebody asks you to take pictures.
Oh, that's easy for me. Nobody asked me to take pictures.
Yeah. I say no sometimes if a client seems like they'd be a nightmare or if the pictures they want me to take are something that I either don't think I would do well or don't think I would really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying no to family and friends, like the times when somebody's just like, can you bring your camera to my wedding? And I was like, I can, but I don't really shoot the kind of pictures you want for your wedding pictures, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's hard to say no or to be able to say, yes, I'd love to come to your wedding, but I'd like to be just a guest.
Or maybe you just don't have the same, you know, creative aesthetic feel you don't have the same vision or the required vision.
Yeah,
for
what I'm going to do is not
X.
what you're looking for. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that happens sometimes. You know, sometimes friends want a whole bunch of stuff for free and sometimes you give them a deal and sometimes you don't. And sometimes you do it for free. And, you know, like it's a case by case basis.
But why are the arts so singular about that?
Yeah. Why is it like if you have to fix my car and I ask you to fix my car because you're a mechanic, I wouldn't expect you to do it for free.
Are you like I have a friend who's a dentist, you know, would you hook me up with a crown?
Yeah, exactly.
It seems like there's a, not to go down a rabbit
hole.
Because
no one does dentistry no one does dentistry for fun.
Right. But I don't want to devalue the whole art thing or get into that big discussion, but it does seem like the arts, visual arts in particular.
Yeah.
There is this idea of, well, you can just show up and do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's always kind of struck me as
no, it is. But I think that being solid in yourself so that you're able to say no is an important thing. And there were times when I wasn't able to say no, but I'm better at being able to say no now. Mm-hmm. But that's being able to draw the lines with a lot of things in your life. You know, people, friends or family or clients who, you know, force you to take on emotional things that you don't want to,
right,
you know, like
right.
all that. I mean, there's all that. I think all that kind of rolls into it and is of the same ilk.
I mean, I got a call the other day from a friend of mine saying, hey, I've got a potential client that wants a website and the business is X. And I told them that you might want to do it. And I gave them your name. So they're going to call you. And it was a business that I just have no interest or stake in, and they called and we talked about it, and I just said,
use Squarespace.
I don't think I'm the right person for this.
Yeah.
And it was weird. It was almost this, well, why not?
Yeah. Joe said, you're the guy, you should work. You don't want work.
It was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was, no, I don't want this work.
Right.
You know,
right,
because
right.
At the end of the day, it's got my name on it as much as it has your name on it. Whether my name is ever seen, I know it's there.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And this is not what I want, you know, on my CV.
Sure, yeah. Tom in Michigan.
Tom in Michigan.
It's a stupid hypothetical. We've been contacted by alien civilization over radio waves from a star system 10 light years away, and you two have been selected to be on the committee to send only 3 pictures back. because that's part of the stupid hypothetical, that you can only send three pictures back. What pictures do you send back to this civilization?
Of all the photographs that have ever been taken, Jeffrey, what are the three most important photographs? Oh, who the
three
hell knows?
Most important, or the three I would send.
Those two people kissing by Robert Doisneau.
Nope. I would send Oswald being shot by Jack Ruby.
Interesting.
I would send the test of the atomic bomb. You know, that big mushroom cloud.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Trinity test photo. Yeah.
Uh huh. And maybe the kiss in Times Square.
Oh, you missed a good one.
What?
Aldrin on the moon.
Oh yeah. Okay, that would be a good one too.
Yeah.
You know, three photos that sort of capture how ridiculously violent we are towards one another, but how
we like to grab nurses who don't want to get kissed.
our capacity for love and our capacity for destruction.
Yeah, fair enough. Good one.
Yeah.
Maybe something in there that's like crazy beautiful, like like our photographer of the week, little bit of a
foreshadowing.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Lauren Shin. Oh, look, we're getting down to the end here. Lauren Shin, can you have a process without product? Assuming that the product can either be tangible, like a piece of art, or intangible, like knowledge, additional knowledge of self or level of happiness. Can you have process without product?
Absolutely.
What is the point of process without product, whether intangible or tangible? Does it need some sort of product at the end, which is some level of satisfaction or some new knowledge for yourself or a print in order to show that it actually happened in the first place?
I don't know. I mean,
is this sort of like, can you not be changed by an experience?
But,
well,
but
of course you're going to
be process,
changed.
Maybe the process is the product. If you go
well,
through
which
a process,
case, yeah.
there will be a sort of, you know, breadcrumb trail.
Right. You will change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In which case,
whether it's, you know, maybe there, knowledge is its own reward type thing.
Right. Well, right. Which is what she's saying. That's one of the intangible products. So I guess the answer is yes, there will always be some sort of product at the end, because you will change because of the experience. So therefore, this is very metaphysical. What is this?
What if you destroy the product
or something?
Yeah. What if you go through this process, you create this art, you create a piece of something, and then you destroy it. The product is gone. It was there temporarily.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the same thing as the guy leaving the guy from last week leaving the stuff out in the rain. The process still affected him. It's still all of that still happened. He learned something from it. So the tangible product's gone, but the intangible feeling of why he did it is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a deep one. That's one that we should all discuss with our shrinks next week.
But yes, I think you can have a process without the product, because even if there is no product, the process is the product.
Okay. Wait. Yeah. So you're saying you can't, or you can't?
Okay. No, I think you can.
Right. I think those things are connected.
Yeah. 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 The process is in some cases the product.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe you're trying, you know, maybe there's a film that never gets finished. Maybe there's a painting that never gets finished. Maybe there's, you know, a sculpture that never gets finished. So there is no real end product that you started out with, or that you started out seeing, wanting, questing.
Right.
But the hero's journey is still the process.
Hero's journey. Tim Lewis, you got this one?
Okay. Peter Evans. There's some weird context things. Number three is a great question.
Great question.
It's a great question.
That is a great question.
That's right. Number three is a great question, and I've been thinking about that myself. Flying solo in Moscow has made me appreciate community much more. However, you could argue that the active portions of the community here in the OTP group has many of the characteristics of a collective, albeit a loose online one. So yeah, just like what we were saying. I do think this is a collective. I think it's a supportive environment. I think it's creative.
Dave Gardner apparently was hosting an OTP friend at his place this weekend.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, which is totally cool. So yeah, I think it happens. All right. So these are a couple from Twitter. Junas. What is one photography-related project or thing that you want to do before the end of 2015? Don't have one? Improvise. Do you have a photography-related thing you want to do?
I do. It's part of this one of the new projects I'm working on, and Doug and the two ladies that I spoke to last time I was here are sort of the beta tests of that. I want to do stories and portraits.
Okay.
Or portraits and stories. But instead of me just sort of recounting it, I want to include the audio. Now, for those of you who listened to the Doug story, there's a whole bunch of audio that goes with that I recorded, but of Doug giving his answers and just having the conversation. But I didn't talk to him about it until sort of after the fact, and I'm not comfortable using it without his permission. I won't use audio without the permission. I told him I was recording for my own notes, which is what I always do. But
so
I didn't
ask him. Next time you see him, you're going to go ask him, you mind if
maybe,
I use the actual audio?
Yeah, maybe, because I didn't ask him before I put the thing up. But I do have audio of it. So that's kind of one of the projects that I definitely want to focus in more on, is doing portraits and conversations where people are speaking in their own words instead of me sort of paraphrasing or speaking for them. Sure. You?
I have a few irons in the fire of just like little projects that I'm working on. Like I'm going to do more of those Mylar ones because I think those are fun.
Mm-hmm. I have one more
short that I want to do this summer, which I've got to get on the stick with, which I want to do like sometime in the next couple months. But that one involves an actual script, so that complicates things because now I got to record good audio on set and, you know, deal with actors actually reading lines and complicates things a little bit.
It's ramping up the difficulty.
Exactly. That's the whole idea. So, that's what I got going on.
All right. Justin's got one for you.
Okay.
Bill, when you take a picture, do you see what it could be, or are you seeing its potential while in post? Is it ever changing? What do you think?
Sure. It's ever changing. You don't end up with exactly what you imagined, like any sort of complex thing. You know, it's like, I'm going to write this book and I know what the plot is, but until you actually write the book, you don't know the intricacies of the plot and how it all interweaves and the tones that end up hitting. I have gotten better over the years of the stuff that involves a lot of post-production, where I kind of know what I think it's going to look like and I know what I need to get in camera in order to do what I need to do after the fact.
Sure.
So I've gotten better at predicting what it's going to end up looking like. So I can sort of really guess what it's going to look like. The thing I shot last night is one of those where it's like, it's going to take a lot of Photoshop work, but I kind of know what I'm going to get, hopefully. So that should work. But I think that the sort of visualization is a big part of it. And that just comes from experience, you know, like you can have a vague idea, like even the serial short I did a couple weeks ago. I mean, that was the vague idea of, oh, Everett likes to eat a lot of cereal. I could imagine the two of them late at night eating cereal and never eating most of the box and then trying to grab Emma's cereal. Like that was what it was. And like, okay, so how does it go from that to the final thing? Well, it just kind of goes. I mean, complex things like recording records. When you used to go in the studio and you're like, oh, I know, I want this band to sound like, I don't know, Smashing Pumpkins or whatever it is. And it's like, well, you're not recording in the same room with the same drums, with the same drummer, with the same effects, with the same mics, the same distance. Like, there's way too many variables for you to know exactly what it's going to end up being. And in some ways, it's going to end up being what it is. Like, you can't control everything. I used to be frustrated by that, and now I've kind of come around to enjoy the fact that I can't control everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm surprised about what something becomes as much as the next guy. So it's kind of cool. Derek, I know there's probably a limit, but I have a few. Yes, Derek, we're down to the last few here. Number one, I struggle to think of a good way to write an about me section to a website. So I was thinking of having a video, made showcasing how, why, and what I shoot with clips of me, at shoots with little slideshows of photographs. What are your opinions about having video instead of text? I've started a similar thing a number of times over the last 4 or 5 years, and I've never actually finished them. I think a lot of people like video and a lot of people like text because they don't want to have speakers on and watching video.
I love the idea of doing video.
But video on the web is a weird thing because, like, sometimes you can't watch video. You know what I mean? Where you can read.
So maybe have both.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
have an abbreviated version of it in text and, yeah. you know, upload it to Vimeo or, yeah. or YouTube so you're not dinged with the bandwidth.
Yeah. It is a cool idea, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've also, whenever I've looked at about me or trying to write sort of like a bio thing, I always look at other people whose work I really like and see what they say. Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, that's an interesting way of phrasing that. Or,
right.
oh, I see how he did that. You know, he wrote it in the third person or the first person or, you know, kind of goes chronologically or no, he only talks about the things that he really likes or, you know, whatever.
Sure.
So that can be useful too. Number two, I'm going to start a personal project on the with the intention of it being based based in a blog. Should I have the photos from the blog also in the galleries on my website? Yeah, if you like them and they're good, sure.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Show what you can do.
Yep. Last one, Jamie.
All right. Jamie Lee Tissier? Tissier? Probably Tissier. Maybe Tissier.
Okay.
I don't know. See, because I went to high school with a guy last name Tessier, and it was T-E-S-S. I-E-R instead of T-I, and it was Tessier.
So this could be Tissier?
Tissier? Yeah. Anyway, how do you know when you have the eye for photography? Oh, you don't.
You never know.
You never know. And even if you know, you're going to question it and second-guess it for the rest of your life.
And anybody who tells you, they can tell you whether you have an eye for...
They're
kooky. That's meaningless, too.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone that whose work you've loved has probably been told that they're terrible at some point or another. So it's
and
not
has
like,
felt that they're terrible.
You know, there was another question, which I don't know, is not in here somewhere. Oh, it was the whole thing about, man, why isn't it in here? I thought that, somebody else had a few questions. And one of them was something along the lines of like, how do you rank yourself against other photographers? I remember that's what it was. Sorry, I didn't add those in here. Like, how do you kind of know where your standing is?
You don't.
And it's like, yeah, you don't. And there is no ranking, right?
It's
like
a that's fool's just, errand.
Yeah. Yeah. It's this
like
isn't,
saying who's the best.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
I mean, there's no statistics. It's not like, oh, this guy has the most home runs, so he's the best baseball player.
Right.
Like, art doesn't work that way. And you really can't even think of it that way because how many artists who are revered now, like the Van Goghs of the world, were completely unknown and no one gave a crap while they were alive? You know, what was it? Pollock, most he ever sold a painting for was like $8,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
In his lifetime.
I think it was like $5,000 was the most he ever made.
Yeah. So, you know, this is not, you can't base it on commercial success. You ultimately what it is that you live and you do stuff while you're alive and then you die. And I'm coming to the conclusion that the best you can do is have experiences and love one another and do the best you can while you're alive. And everything else is just out of your control. And so if you like taking pictures, great. Keep taking pictures. If you feel frustrated because you don't think you're doing as good as you could do, well, either keep working at it or do something else. But there, you know, there's no shame in any of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know when you have the eye? It's not binary. There's no eye for photography.
Right. And even if you start out thinking that you do, you may eventually end up thinking that you don't or vice versa.
Yeah.
You may grow into your aesthetic. You may grow into your style. You may grow into your ability and you may grow into your confidence.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's true. Things change in your own head. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's this really crazy question. Yeah. All about ranking yourself. What if I suck? What if I succeed? Like you can't think that way. Or rather thinking that way doesn't get you anywhere.
Right.
I think that's it. I think it's good enough for now, right?
That's it, yeah. Can I do one more?
Sure.
A couple people have emailed, and I think there was even one on the group of asking why DC for me.
Yeah.
As opposed to like Portland or sure. or something. And the short answer is I just feel like there's a lot of opportunity here. There's a lot of proximity to other places. And I think, you know, to compare the two places, they're both great cities. Portland's a terrific city. I've had a lot of fun there. I have friends there. It's, you know, it's great food. It's great weather. It's great environment. Where I think they're different is Portland is a maker town.
Yeah.
And they're very proud of making and the maker culture and all that. And I think DC is more of a curator town.
Sure.
And that just feels right to me right now. And I think it feels right based on what's on the horizon for me in terms of both personal and professional projects.
Yeah.
There's also the idea of proximity to other places, to New York, to Philly, to...
And I think it's even more different as far as your experience. DC, the East Coast is further away from your old experience than Portland.
Sure, sure. I'm very much looking forward to seeing how seasons and cycles affect...
Like you could theoretically go get in your car and come have dinner with me tonight.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. Yeah. And I'm that's, you know, that's another thing that I'm looking forward to.
You don't know
to.
Where I live, do you?
No. Don't I just go to Brooklyn?
Yeah. Aren't you the only house in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
I can go to Brooklyn, just start asking for you, right?
Hey, where's Bill?
Who?
Where's Bill?
Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
I'm looking forward to seeing how the difference in lifestyle affects my creative output, my sort of cultural appreciation. I'm looking forward to making new friends. I'm looking forward to meeting new people. I'm looking forward to just seeing where this chapter takes me.
Yeah.
So that's the short answer. More to be, you know, revealed.
Assignment. How did people do last week?
Oh my gosh. Shockingly well. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some absolutely fantastic work.
I haven't
up
looked
there.
In a day, so let me see if I can get over
there.
There
Dennis,
is parking lot.
Parking lot for autumn. A great shot of a plane.
That picture,
James.
Yeah, that picture is creepy.
That Millie. I mean, there's just a terrific.
Who would have thought that parking lot would be a thing?
Right.
So a lot of people went super macro, right? They went like down to, I'm going to show you a single stripe on the ground or a piece of paint.
Yeah.
Other people, Perrin did a street sort of stop motion thing on the street.
Right.
David Lawrence is all about the weather. Mo Morgan, it's all about cracks in a crazy empty parking lot.
Tanya, I love that with the tire leaning up against the facade there.
Yeah.
I like that shot by Mo.
Mo.
Penny Brook, parking lot, Love Motel, Seoul, South Korea. This is the other thing. We've got listeners all over the world, and I love seeing these little sort of slices of life from other parts of the world that I may or may not ever experience.
Yep, absolutely.
What's this? Kathy Hatfield, Color Run at a Bible school. Look at all the colored smoke in the air as they're running and playing. That's really cool. Almost like one of the Holi Festival in India.
Yes, very much like
a mini Holi Festival. Todd, great shot of that parking lot, station wagon in a parking lot. This was a fun one.
Yeah. See, sometimes the simple, silly ones actually end up being something.
Right.
And so if you don't know what we're talking about, the On Taking Pictures group over on Google Plus, we'll put a link in the show notes, or you can go over to Google Plus and search for On Taking Pictures and you can join the group. Is we do these assignments and you can, people post their work and have good discussions and critique each other's work in a very, good manner, very
positive.
Welcoming, positive manner.
Yep.
So we'll put a link in the show notes.
A lot
or just
of
go
good
search
stuff.
For it.
David Dickey, this is an oldie, but I've always wanted to use it for something. Taken in 2010 while driving to the ATP festival in Minehead. It's this sort of misty nighttime gas station parking lot.
Yeah.
Kinda
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Really like that. So yeah, good stuff. Keep them coming. And look, if you don't let the day of the show mess you up, if you want to go back and take a stab at some of the older assignments or keep posting this, friend of the show and actually one of the moderators of the show, Chris Matheson, has a listing of all of the photographers of the week and all of the assignments that he has been kind enough to maintain. And I think it's just Christopher Matheson. I'm sorry, chrismatheson.com/on-taking-pictures. And you can see all of the assignments and all of the photographers of the week that we've done so far for 171 episodes.
All right. So what's this week's assignment?
Well, you know, this week, just based on some of the questions around, you know, what would you keep? That's right. favorite thing. Show us some of the things that are valuable to you. What would you keep?
Okay.
What do you think? Is that okay?
I think it's great.
Favorite things. So
favorite things.
Hashtag favorite things.
And Freddie, this is family friendly. All right. just a reminder.
Freddie's gonna post pictures of his real doll.
You ready for photographer of the week?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to have a hard time pronouncing it. Anwar Pajani.
Pajani.
Could
Anwar
be.
Anwar Pajani.
This came. Somebody sent this in, and a number of my friends have been talking about it. This guy's photograph of these whales underwater with a bunch of divers is like one of the cooler photos I've seen in years. It's pretty amazing.
Well, that whole set, looking up at the bottom of the boat with the silhouettes of the sharks swimming around. I mean, that's some super cool stuff, right?
This
there.
Is stuff that I personally would not ever want to do. Those whales and sharks freak me the hell out.
Yeah, look at shot. Well,
I like the
10
ones, yeah, the crazy
series.
Ones with the all the things swirling around him.
Yeah,
oh, that's amazing. Shot number 10.
Yeah, shot number 10.
Yeah, look at
series.
Those sharks.
Yeah,
it's like 12 sharks. Those are big boys too. Those are like, yeah, no, thank you.
Number 17. Look at the size of those rays. These are rays that are probably 10, 12 feet across.
Yeah, they're the size of a Volkswagen.
Yeah, that they're down there swimming with. That's amazing.
No, thank
Gosh.
You.
Gosh, beautiful.
Lovely work. And even the go look at like the stuff in Iceland and stuff. This guy is amazing.
Yeah.
This is like it's this guy's one of the great sort of.
Wow. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. He's a Mexican.
Cuba, Mexico, Iceland, Africa.
Yeah. Amazing work. So we'll put a link in the show notes.
This is beautiful.
And I feel
stuff.
Like there's a
grandness to this. There's a sense of sort of wonder to this work.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, especially the underwater stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great
work in Zanzibar. Look at these portraits in Zanzibar.
That just reminds me of Billy Joel.
Or Freddie Mercury.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think he won the National Geographic competition. The National Geographic Traveler Contest he won.
Well-deserved,
yeah.
Based on what I'm looking at here. This is beautiful work.
Yeah, I'll put a couple links in the show notes so you guys can check that out. But do yourself a favor and check it out because it's really, really good
stuff. Primarily black and white, which is interesting. I always find it interesting when photojournalists, documentary photographers are still shooting black and white or make those choices to shoot in black and white. There's something about those photographs that for me anyway, still really tap into something on a very deep level.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause whenever I turn things black and white and play with them, I almost invariably I go back to the color and go, oh yeah, the color's better.
Hmm.
But you know, I think maybe if you decided to say, no, I'm going to shoot black and white, it changes the way you look at things too, especially the underwater stuff. Everything's blue underwater.
Right.
So it's like, you're not losing that much by losing the color.
His black and white work is really punchy too.
Yeah, super punchy.
It's super, super contrasty.
Some of it almost looks kind of HDR-esque, like he's really opening up the shadows and...
Shh, don't say that.
Okay. I wouldn't dare.
Don't say that.
Well, it's not like Trey Radcliffe is doing it. See what I did there?
I see what you did there.
Yeah. you got anything else to add before we wrap this up? Oh, hey, last Tuesday, I did a little hour-long interview with our friend Abidian X Parello over at the Candid Frame.
The Candid Frame,
where I talked
to
him.
Turning the tables.
Yeah, where I talked to him about what he's learned from doing 10 years of the show, and it's I think it's an interesting conversation. And if you're a Candid Frame fan or you like listening to me talk too much, go listen because I think we got into some interesting stuff.
And if you're not a Candid Frame fan, you should be.
Yeah.
Because he's the best. He really is terrific.
I think I said at the end, I was just like, you know, if you're not listening to Candid Frame, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Stop listening to TWIP and go listen to the Candid Frame.
Exactly. So go check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's also over on my blog, billwadman.com/blog. And you'll find it there over the next few days. And let's see. Get a hold of us. Let's see, where do we start? Podcast at ontakingpictures.com, where you can leave us a voicemail, 347-687-9411, or tweet at us, at Bill Wadman, at Jeffries Doris, and I think we are the same on Instagram.
Yep.
And now that we're both on the East Coast, you can bother us at any time.
Yes. I really want to talk about doing a mid-September, mid-Atlantic meetup.
We could do that. Yeah. We could do a New Jersey thing, or we could do a New York thing and then a DC thing. We could do all three.
Absolutely. Would love it. Love to meet all you guys.
And got anything else?
Nope.
All right. We will see you next week.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say.